right myself, the narrow span of my chained feet keeping me from shifting my weight. I thought I saw a glimmer of pride in his eyes, seeing how difficult it was for me to move. They led me through the double doorway of a wide, empty room. I'd been here once before, on the December day of Eid, when Nigel and I were invited to join our captors for prayer and we'd celebrated what Eid was about, the willingness of Abraham to sacrifice his own son to God. The room was bright with sunshine. Its walls were painted yellow. I'd stood behind my captors on the holiday morning looking at their backs. I'd knelt on the concrete floor, watching daylight drift through two windows on the left-hand wall, fascinated by the sight of the single stunted tree in the wide yard beyond. What they saw, and I usually didn't. This time, Abdullah pushed me to the front of the room. Skids was talking again in Somali, saying words that Abdullah translated for my benefit. "You are a bad woman," he said, his voice rising. "You run away. Do you have documents?" I said, "Documents? No, I don't have any documents." "You lie," Abdullah said. I realized that they must have searched Nigel's room and found the paper on which he'd written some Somali phrases asking for help. It was hardly a document, but our captors had always been obsessed by what they called documents. Any paper with words on it. The written word held a strange power for them. Skids drew close, the first time in 5 months that he'd come within spitting distance of me. I didn't like what I saw in his eyes. Instinctively, I shot a hand out to push him away, but this seemed to make his motion swifter. With his left hand, he seized the neckline of my red dress and, in the same instant, used his opposite hand to crack the butt end of his pistol over my skull. I felt the pain in my teeth, my eyeballs, my fingertips. My first thought was that he damaged my brain. I fell sideways, but Skid still had a hold on my dress. He yanked me up and then pulled the dress over my head, his fingers finding my sweat-stained tank top. When I fought him, he hit me again. "Please, please, don't do this," I said. Skids barked an order at Abdullah, and I began to understand why they'd had me bring the sheep from my bed. With Skids holding my arms, Abdullah took my piece of flowered cotton and hooded me with it, covering my head and tying it tightly at the back of my neck. Now I saw nothing but blue light. I felt hands on my body. My tank top was torn away. I twisted and squirmed, trying to dodge the hands, but they only came from new angles. Someone landed another blow on my head. I was dizzy, vomit rising in my throat. I felt myself sag. There were new voices in the room, more people speaking Somali. I heard Muhammad and Yusuf. The room seemed crowded suddenly, dense with male energy. I heard the voice of Hassan, the sweet young market boy, and that, more than anything, made my spirits plummet. I thought, not him, too. Someone was tugging on my jeans, sliding them down to just above where the chains lay yoked around my ankles. The air in the room was hot, and I was naked but for the hood over my head and the jeans at my feet. My skin prickled. I pressed my arms over my breasts and hips, trying to cover myself. Down by my feet, I could feel a set of hands moving around my ankles. I heard a murmuring and then a collective gasp. Someone announced the name of Ajos, the fixer at the Shamo. My heart sank at the sound. They'd been searching through the pockets I knew and had come upon my one bit of contraband. It was the two tiny scraps of paper onto which, prior to the escape, I'd copied my Somali phrases and phone numbers. I'd rolled the papers up until they were about the size of two sunflower seeds and tucked them into the narrow triangular front pocket of my jeans. My captors were talking loudly, excitedly, almost triumphantly, as if they had permission now to continue. And they did, they continued. They called it a search, what they went on to do to me that morning in that room. But what they did was drag us all into a new territory. All of the boys were there. I understood later how much this mattered, how it kept any one of them from judging the others in the months to come. Together they crossed into a darker place, where there was no retrievable dignity for anybody. They became guilty, one the same as the other. I bled not for hours or days, but for weeks afterward. Chapter 34. New Rules. From here I went into darkness. By this I mean real physical darkness, a bleak void with four walls around it, in the form of a new room in a new house, this one seeming to be farther outside of Mogadishu, deeper in the countryside, somewhere in the catacombs of another whitewashed village. Shrouded in my black abaya and headscarf, just hours after what had happened in the prayer room, under cover of night they brought us, me and Nigel both, to the new location. I was strangely numb during the ride. My body had been shredded. Blood seeped beneath the abaya. So much of me was raw and hurt that I couldn't shift my weight without triggering a new pain. All the while, my mind felt caught in a net, rigged high above what was going on. Next to me, Nigel was panting so loudly I feared they'd hit him for it. He was shirtless, for reasons I didn't want to imagine. In the back of the car, where several of the boys sat jammed beneath the hatchback with their guns, I could hear the rattling of cooking pots and plastic bags at their feet, a sign that they'd packed us up for the full move. I saw almost nothing of the next house. I was hurried from the car through a doorway and then down a long hall. Before we were pulled inside, I turned to Nigel and said one thing. "Stay strong," I said. "We'll get out of here, Nige, but we might not see each other for a while." My eyes welled at the thought. He, too, teared up. Despite everything, I wanted to crawl into his arms. They put me in a room that was windowless and black, tossing in my foam mattress, several bags of my belongings, and the brown square of linoleum that appeared to travel with me now as well. The room was big. My mat lay in one corner, with the other walls far away. The air smelled sour, a stew of rot and urine. The room felt sealed off like a cave, like a storage room, removed from light and the busier parts of the house. There was a bathroom inside the room, in an alcove near the doorway, smelling dank and unused. Over 22 weeks of captivity, I'd nursed many thoughts that somehow Nigel and I would be found, that some cell phone signal could be traced and mapped, that maybe Canada or Australia would find a way to send soldiers or mercenaries to pluck us out, or that someone, one of our captors' wives or cousins or mothers, would blow the whistle on the whole operation and it would force an ending. My hopes had been dimming, but in the airless jar of the new room, they felt fully snuffed. I'd lost a lot of blood and was burning with fever. My head ached viciously. I was certain I was dying and that it would happen slowly. As I lay on the mattress, my mind clung to the faintest of sounds. The scrabble of a rat in the far corner of the room. Someone hammering something, a mosquito net likely, into a wall. I heard something else, a light hacking coming from the hallway, a human cough I didn't recognize. The sound was distinctly female, but that seemed impossible. I wondered if I was hallucinating. Eventually I slept, figuring that morning would relieve some of the pain and also the darkness. When I awoke, though, I was dry-mouthed and soaked in sweat, with chills running through my body, the bruises tender beneath the surface of my skin. From my mattress, I could see only a thin line of daylight running along the bottom of the door to the room, illuminating nothing. This was the dark house. There were new rules here. My captors had made them clear right away. I was not allowed to speak, nor was I allowed to sit up on my mat, not even for a minute. I was permitted to eat and drink only by propping myself on one elbow from my spot on the mat. Any infraction brought a beating. My prison was no longer the size of a room. It had shrunk to the size of that mat, 3 feet wide by 7 feet long. Gone, too, was the practice of bringing me plastic bottles of filtered water from the market, I was delivered the same 2-liter bottle every morning, refilled from what must have been an outdoor tap with water that tasted like iron and left grit on my tongue. On the second afternoon, Abdullah came into the room with a flashlight and found me lying on my back. He gave me a furious kick. "Over," he said, using his toe to lever me to my side. "Like this only. No exercise." He kicked me again to drive home whatever point he was making. I realized later that they'd seen me go through my hours of daily pacing back at the last house, in the weeks leading up to our attempt at escape. I remembered the look of frantic rage on Abdullah's face as he'd chased me through the mosque, the force of my legs thrashing as he dragged me across the courtyard. He wouldn't risk a repeat. They were going to do all they could to keep me weak. I was banned from lying on my back for fear that somehow it would make me strong. I guess they thought I'd start doing leg lifts or crunches and find another way out. 5 times a day, I was allowed to totter the few yards to the toilet, lassoed by the chains, with a boy and gun poised nearby. The bathroom had a small ventilation grate high in the wall that, during the day, let in a feeble mosaic of light, enough to reveal a Western toilet that didn't flush, a sink without running water, and a rusted showerhead in the corner. The water came from a jug left inside the door. After washing, I was expected to pray. I was now happy to pray, as it constituted the only bit of variety in my movement, the only moments I was allowed to remain upright aside from bathroom trips. Most of the time, one or two of my captors stood behind me as I prayed, using a flashlight or the silvery screen of a cell phone to provide light, watching as I went through the motions, murmuring the words, using my square of linoleum as a prayer mat. The leg shackles bit into my ankles as I moved from standing to kneeling. I could no longer sit back on my heels to finish each cycle of prayer. The boys mocked my Arabic. They mimicked the pitch of my voice, my poor pronunciation. "You are a bad Muslim, Amina," Abdullah said to me, his laughter like a horsewhip traveling the darkness. "You are liar woman." By the 4th day, I was ill from the dirty water. My stomach scorched, my intestines gurgling. I used my plastic water bottle to knock on the floor, signaling I needed extra trips to the bathroom. Sometimes the boys obliged me, and sometimes they didn't. They'd taken to leaving the wooden door to my room slightly ajar, which gave them the ability to sneak in noiselessly, to surprise me while I was sleeping. I woke a few times to find Abdullah and young Muhammad throwing my belongings against the wall, demanding to know if I had documents, the beams of their flashlights raking over me. With the move to the dark house, they'd taken away my books and medicine. I still had the Q-tips and the body lotion. I had a single change of clothes, the bottle of perfume, and the king-size toothpaste. But that was about it. The one new item I had, which had somehow ended up in my things, was a shirt belonging to Nigel. It was the shirt he'd worn during our escape, a purple button-up shirt that was torn in several places and missing a sleeve. I kept it in bed with me, sleeping with it pulled close. I dozed in a fevered haze, my brain drifting, my body on fire. In the darkness, I felt myself shrinking toward nothing. Once I awoke in a panic to the feeling of someone kicking me repeatedly in the side. It was Muhammad, his foot jammed beneath my ribcage. It took me a few seconds to understand what he was doing. I'd accidentally rolled onto my back while sleeping, breaking the no-exercise rule. He kicked me until I rolled back to my side. A few times, I heard the faint sound of Nigel, his chains clinking in the hallway outside. I also heard, again and again, that unfamiliar cough coming from somewhere inside the house. It was jarring, barky, and decidedly female. I heard it at night and I heard it by day, which seemed to suggest she was living there. Whoever she was, she sounded quite sick. It confused my sense of things. Why would a woman be so near? Was she another captive? A wife? A servant? My mind reeled at her presence, though I was well past thinking that any woman, in any circumstance, would be able to save me. Whoever she was, I guessed she was just as stuck as I was. When you are in darkness, time folds in on itself, surreal and elastic. It bellows like an accordion stretching and then collapsing. An hour becomes indistinguishable from a night or a day. My mattress floated like a raft in the middle of a black ocean. The darkness surrounding me had substance. It had weight. It was thick like tar catching in my throat and gumming up my lungs. I had to coach myself on how to breathe it. There were moments when the darkness seemed aggressive, like it was trying to swallow me. I'd hold a hand in front of my face and see nothing. I fanned my arms, attempting to create wind to exert some power over the dark. Sometimes I pressed the hollow at the base of my neck, just to remind myself I was solid. 8 days passed and then a ninth. I tried not to obsess about time, but without the rhythm of day and night, it was almost impossible not to. My thoughts were simple. Don't panic, don't go crazy. I pushed my brain around like a miniature train on a track, traveling the same small circles. Stay calm, I told myself. This has to be temporary. They're going to move us out of here soon. I marked the days by following the summonses to prayer. It sounded like there was a mosque right next door to our house, literally just beyond my walls. The muezzin's singing voice was old and unpleasant. My eyes strained against the blackness, causing a nearly constant headache. I began to keep them closed all the time, which was an effort, a disruption of the brain. I focused instead on my hearing, which I could feel was getting sharper. In the afternoons, I could hear a tinny-sounding radio tuned to the BBC Somali service, its announcer speaking in Somali. I listened for words I could recognize. I knew very few. Most of my vocabulary accrued during the first several days in Mogadishu with Abdi, and in the early weeks of captivity, when our captors were eager to converse. I knew the words for rice and onion and water. I knew the words Somalis used for hotel, journalist, bathroom, mosque. I knew how are you and I am good and help and we are doing everything we can to save lives. But little of this surfaced on the radio. The words I caught most often were the names of places and famous people. Over days of listening, I thought I heard the Somali newsman mention Mogadishu in Ethiopia, Germany and George Bush. The words, in their familiarity, were almost like food. Occasionally I heard the clatter of a cooking pot somewhere in the house, along with the woman's cough as she moved about. I began to think she was likely a cook hired to fix meals for the boys and clean up after them. I heard them delivering bags from the market to what must have been a kitchen at the end of my hallway. Every so often I caught the smell of onions frying in a pan. I decided she must be a widow, desperate for a job. No Somali woman of standing, unmarried or married, young or old, would be allowed to live with a group of young men as she was doing. And Somalia, I knew, had no shortage of widows. From the words, from the sounds, I sometimes slipped into dreams. Once with my eyes closed, I thought I heard the sound of Nigel laughing, but I didn't fully trust my own brain. It was wishful thinking, I realized. I was wretchedly, unsparingly lonely. I pictured Nigel in a dark room somewhere on the other side of the house. I sent him mental messages, imploring him to hang on, to stay strong. I couldn't stay angry with him for having tried to pin the escape attempt on me. He was just so scared. I understood. None of it mattered anyway. I tried to imagine him sending me messages back. In my lowest moments, I curled myself around his ripped shirt and cried. I lay with the fabric under my cheek, smelling the swampish scent of his body. We had a history now that added up to years. We had a catalog of shared experiences, though all I could recall for the moment, with my nose pressed into his shirt, was the sweaty paranoia of our escape, the frantic dash into the mosque. It was not a good memory, but it carried an electrical charge, a feeling I desperately needed. We'd been hopeful for how long that day? 10 minutes? 12? I wished for even 3 seconds of that hopefulness now. I craved just one hit of lung-clearing, odds stacked against us, totally fucked up but still not impossible possibility. In the darkness, left with no other option, I tried to inhale it out of the fibers of that shirt. Chapter 35, A House in the Sky. 2 weeks passed, then a third, and then something closer to a month. I lay in nothingness, drifting deeper into a state of half-being, the stale darkness eating away all boundaries. I saw skeins of blue thread, little plume-like spinnakers that floated in front of me, whether my eyes were open or shut. Sometimes I wondered if I'd gone blind. Other times I wondered if I was alive at all. Was this hell? It was not an unreasonable thought. Gradually, I found my way into a sense of routine, curbed on all sides by the dark and the rules. But still, there was comfort in anything I could do for myself. I arranged my small collection of toiletries in a line along the top end of my mat. I used the body lotion in the mornings after my bathroom trip, massaging the cream into my hands and forearms and over my face. My captors had given me a razor, a small straight-edged blade kept in a paper sheath. With it, I was supposed to shave my pubic area daily, in keeping with conservative Islam's mandates on body hair. I did this in the dim light of the bathroom, testing the blade's sharpness against my skin, knowing that if I wanted to, I could probably slash my wrists with it. It was a thought, an idea waiting to be activated, but nothing more. Each morning between visiting the bathroom and lying down again, I stole 15 critical seconds to make up the bed, tucking the bottom sheet tightly beneath the sides of the mattress, using a hand to smooth any wrinkles. I folded my blue floral top sheet into a neat flat rectangle and set it at the foot. This, for me, marked the beginning of a new day. To pass the time, I reminded myself of what I knew, of things that tied me to the world beyond. It was February, almost March. Back at home, the Rocky Mountains would be covered in layers of deep white snow. My mother would be wearing a scarf. My father's gardens would be crushed and brown. The sidewalks in Calgary would be scoured by snaking winter winds. Wool, wind, dead flowers. I tried to feel them on my skin. I'd spent so many of my winters away from Canada in far-off countries where it rarely got cold. Now, more than anything, I wanted the feel of a season, the coziness of a warm, safe house with the cold world outside. In my room, the rats got bolder. I sometimes woke to the hairy brush of a body scuttling over my legs in the dark. I looked for any pinprick of light, any movement inside the vacuum of blackness, but there was none. My legs ached from the enforced stillness. I rolled from my right side to my left, and then back. I felt woozy and ill. I tried to drink as little as possible of the water they brought me. I ate what they carried in each morning with the same hesitancy. Dry bread, pieces of camel fat over rice, bananas. All outside sounds seemed to come from a different world. Only the crotchety voice of the muezzin next door was clear, and the footsteps. The sound of a pair of sandals approaching my door. Hearing them, I'd feel my heart start to pound. I don't think I experienced something as simple as fear anymore. What I felt when someone came near me was a hot explosion of terror. With the footsteps, I never knew who was coming or why. Most often it was Abdullah. The others paid visits to my room, too. Sometimes under the pretense that they were inspecting me to see if I'd kept up with shaving my body hair, but often to abuse me. If, before the escape, I had been a curiosity to those boys, a foreign woman with whom they could practice their English while earning points with Allah for indoctrinating me into Islam, all that was gone. Now they treated me as a spoil of war. Some were worse than others. A few, like Hassam and Jamal, left me alone. But as a group, they seemed to believe that I'd shame them by making a false accusation in the mosque, and that justified ditching whatever sense of dignity or communal restraint once held them back. Abdullah sometimes came several times in a single day. He'd open the door and blind me with the beam of his flashlight. Then he'd drop to his knees on my mat, usually without a word. He didn't so much touch me as grab handfuls of my flesh. He'd find one of my breasts in the darkness and squeeze it like something he hoped would burst. Sometimes he'd tell me in a sneering voice that I was dirty and open, since, unlike those of virtually all Somali women, my genitals had not been cut. My labia and clitoris had not been sliced off and my vagina stitched shut in some draconian bid to protect my honor. Sometimes Abdullah tied my hands behind my back with the blue-flowered sheet from my mattress so I wouldn't push at him as he choked me. I blocked out the sounds he made. Death began to look welcoming. Whatever death was, it had to be better. I wasn't sure how I would die, even with the razor. I had no urge to end my own life, but I could feel death close by, waiting for me. Death would require no effort, just the letting go. In my chest, I could feel pressure building every day, even every hour, as if a tree bough were bending inside me. I felt like I was approaching the point where I could no longer bear the strain, as if my mind were about to snap. The thought completely unnerved me. What would come with the snap? What lay on the other side? Death? Or madness? I didn't know. I lay still as Abdullah did what he did, but my mind never stopped clamoring to get away. I fought not to cross over. I fought to undo some of the pressure. He usually set his flashlight down on the floor. As he moved over me, exerting himself, his tongue poked slightly out of his mouth. The beam of his light shone up and away from us, illuminating things I otherwise never saw. The dark wooden beams of the ceiling, and the dust particles that hung suspended in the air like little diamonds. I focused on these. I tried to climb away from the shock of what my life had become. In my mind, I built stairways. At the end of the stairways, I imagined rooms. These were high, airy places with big windows and a cool breeze moving through. I imagined one room opening brightly onto another room until I built a house, a place with hallways and more staircases. I built many houses, one after another, and those gave rise to a city, a calm, sparkling city next to the ocean, a place like Vancouver. I put myself there, and that's where I lived, in the wide-open sky of my mind. I made friends and read books and went running on a footpath in a jewel-green park along the harbor. I ate pancakes drizzled in syrup and took baths and watched sunlight pour through the trees. It wasn't longing, and it wasn't insanity. It was relief. It got me through. After he'd gone, my other emotions came streaming back. I cried every time, unsettled by the rushes of fury and despair. I felt like I was standing next to an ocean slicked with hate, my toes wet with it. Day by day, though, I collected up old sweetnesses and fed on them. I remembered the happier moments in my life, unfolding them with languorous slowness, time being the one currency I had to spend. I revisited my early love for Jamie, with his mop hair and his thrift store outfits and his guitar. "Where do you want to go?" he'd asked one afternoon in a park by the river in Calgary, back before we'd been to a single place or seen a single thing. "Anywhere," I'd said. "Anywhere is good." It had been the right answer. In exacting detail, I could recall the rub of a heavy backpack on my shoulders, the petrol blur of Pakistani jingle trucks, the train stations and lamb kebabs, the flame-colored tent I'd slept in on the riverbank in Khartoum. I took myself back through the week I'd spent trekking to Everest Base Camp in Nepal one year with Kelly, the first nights I'd slept in a Monuddin's house in Kabul. I recalled what it was like to scoop handfuls of sugared pistachios into my mouth in Calcutta, and to dip triangles of soft pita bread into a bowl of creamy hummus served with mint sprigs in Beirut. I remembered the boy, that quiet, carefully dressed British stranger named Dan Hanmer, who'd sat by the green-black lake in Guatemala so many years ago holding Kelly's hand. I remember diving into pools, cold bottles of orange Fanta at the end of long bus trips, the start of every conversation launched in the breakfast room of a 2-star hostel, out there in the world. I conjured my father's laugh and my mother's cooking, the stars in the sky over Sylvan Lake. I made peace with anyone who might ever have been an enemy. I asked forgiveness for every vain or selfish thing I'd done in my life. Inside the house in the sky, all the people I loved sat down for a big holiday meal. I was safe and protected. It was where all the voices that normally tore through my head expressing fear and wishing for death went silent, until there was only one left speaking. It was a calmer, stronger voice, one that to me felt divine. It said, "See? You are okay, Amanda. It's only your body that's suffering, and you are not your body. The rest of you is fine." Things became more bearable then, not easier, just more endurable. Though I was hungry, bruised, and had a fever I couldn't shake, the rest of me was fine. I was alone and shackled, but the rest of me was okay. The rest of me knew not to panic, it had a place to go. It was as if that voice had come and quietly rearranged a few key things. As if, inside the stifling darkness, I'd been given more space, a cool pocket of air. I reminded myself again to breathe. I put a hand on my chest to be sure each exhale was really happening. I moved from one breath to the next. I followed my breathing from moment into hour, day into week, as the boys came and went from my room, as my hatred for them swelled and receded, each time feeling as if I were climbing hand over hand out of a dark hole. This endlessly cascading place they threw me into every time they raped me, or beat me, or said something horrible to me. It was easier, I decided, for them to think of me a certain way, not to acknowledge that I was a human like them, because if they did, if any one of them stopped to think about what they were doing, they too might snap. With this breath, I choose peace. With this breath, I choose freedom. It didn't matter whether it was the 10th time or the 1,000th. Enduring their cruelties never became any easier. It always had the same effect, consuming me, putting me in a knotted and unhopeful despair. I'd spent my life believing that people were, at heart, good and kind. This was what the world had shown me. But I couldn't find anything good about these boys, about any of my captors. If human beings could be this monstrous, maybe I'd had everything wrong. If this was the world, I didn't want to live in it. That was the scariest and most disabling thought of all. One day, sometime into the second month at the Dark House, Yusuf, the oversized boy who sometimes led the others in calisthenics in the yard, came into my room with a flashlight and handed me a softball-sized half of a papaya cut crosswise with a knife, its seeds making a dark star in the center. I stared at the fruit and then at Yusuf, who was dressed in a sarong and a white t-shirt with thin black stripes. Nobody had smiled at me in many weeks, but he was smiling. I waited for him to lash out at me or take the fruit away, but he didn't. I knew from earlier attempts to talk to him that he spoke almost no English. He patted his own chest to make sure I understood that the fruit was a gift from him alone. Then he sat a few feet away as I bit into it. Very softly I said, "Thank you." The sound of my voice surprised me. I'd barely said a word in weeks. Yusuf smiled again. As I continued to eat, he leaned in my direction and reached his arm out, lining it up with mine so our forearms were side by side in the beam of his flashlight. "Black," he said, pointing at his arm. He then gestured at mine. "White," he said. Looking directly into my eyes, he said, "No problem." I was pretty sure he was telling me that our skin color didn't matter. When he left, I got teary. The whole thing had been so odd. Yusuf was no less guilty than the other boys, but the small kindness stayed with me. The strong and calm voice stayed also. It told me to look for good because good was always there. On days when I was really struggling, when I felt the pressure in my mind moving again towards a snapping point, the voice posed questions. It said, "In this exact moment, are you okay?" The answer, in that exact moment, was steadying. Yes, right now I am still okay. I ran through the things I had to be thankful for. My family at home, the oxygen in my lungs. I started a ritual for myself. Each evening after the 6 o'clock prayer session, I settled back on my mat and went through my own silent appeal, naming every person in my family, taking time to picture each face, asking that they all be protected. I did the same for Nigel and his family and for each one of my friends. I went through the people I'd worked with in Baghdad, the Somalis I'd met in my first few days in Mogadishu. I prayed for the neighbor who tried to help me and Nigel during our escape, and especially for the woman who'd clung to me in the mosque. I prayed that she was alive and unhurt. I pushed out the guilt that followed my hopes. I tried to locate what had been good about the day that had just passed. I looked for any moments where my captors had shown their humanity. I'm thankful that today Jamal set my food down on the floor instead of throwing it at me. I'm grateful that Abdullah offered the greeting Assalamu alaikum when he came into my room. I'm happy that I heard a few seconds of the boys laughing and horsing around in the hallway today because it reminded me, if only for a minute, that somewhere inside of each of them is a teenager who wants to be carefree. In the context of the life I once lived, these were small things, ridiculous things, really. But in this place and under these circumstances, they meant everything. By concentrating on what I was grateful for, I managed to work loose the knots. Each time my captors threw me into that hole, I found another way to climb out. It wasn't easy. Not ever, not once. But this way of thinking became my ladder, my doorway. Anywhere, anywhere, I reminded myself. I could go anywhere. Chapter 36. Danger is coming. In Alberta, it was early spring. My mother continued to live in the government-rented house in Sylvan Lake, not far from my dad and Perry's home. On the wall, she kept a calendar with each of the 210 days that I'd been held hostage marked with an X. RCMP negotiators stayed on duty with her 24 hours a day. She was, however, no longer negotiating. After the last time my mother and I had spoken, in December when the kidnappers threatened to behead me in the desert before handing me the phone, the investigators shifted their strategy, instructing her not to answer the phone any time a Somali number popped up on the caller ID. The idea was that if she stopped picking up, Adam would be forced to deal with a team of Canadian intelligence agents based in Nairobi instead. This, people seemed to believe, would lessen the emotional manipulation and yield more progress. Adam's frustration with the new phone situation was evident. He sometimes called my mother's number more than 10 times in a day, hanging up without leaving a voicemail. Denied phone access, he sent angry emails filled with misspellings to the Hotmail address my mother had used when arranging to send our care package in the fall. One message, sent back in January, around the time of our escape attempt, summed up his ongoing point in its subject line. "Danger is coming soon to Amanda and Nigel if you don't pay the ransom we want." 7 months into the kidnapping, the hostage takers had barely budged in their ransom demands. They were insisting on $2 million for both of us, down from the initial request for $3 million. Adam had rejected a one-time offer of $250,000 made early on in exchange for me and Nigel, an amount that had been put together by the Canadian and Australian governments and was technically categorized as expense money so that each country could maintain its official policy of not paying ransoms. They would offer nothing more than that. Any other solutions would have to come through diplomacy. My parents were given only vague pictures of what diplomacy looked like. Sometimes they were told a government might offer to fund a hospital in a place like Mogadishu, say, as a way of helping to enlist the local government. They were informed that Canadian officials had been trying to put pressure on clan leaders and other Somali leaders to compel our release. But with the Somali government in a constant state of peril, and amid reports that the group holding us had no strong affiliation with any one clan, again and again they came up dry. The stalemate continued. Adam kept phoning my mother to no avail. Other calls came in from Somalia, and various strangers left voice messages claiming to have news or a way to get us free. My mother never understood how people got her number, nor what they were after, whether they were connected to the kidnappers or just honest people trying to help. She usually wept, watching the ringing phone. Expectancy, sustained over many months, becomes its own agony. In the late afternoons, after it was nighttime in Somalia, when there'd likely be no news coming, my mother would leave the house for a sanity break. She'd go to the grocery store or for a solitary walk in the snowy woods nearby, trying to settle her thoughts. The negotiator on duty stayed back at the house, keeping vigil, though it was hard to say what anybody was waiting for. What my parents lived on, what they built their faith on, was the idea that others seemed hopeful. The government officers who called with daily briefings from Ottawa gave them opaque but reassuring intelligence reports. Nigel and I were being fed, they'd been told. We were being allowed to exercise. When, early on, my mother had fretted aloud about her worries for my safety as a woman, the investigators had been quick to soothe her. Among devout Muslims, rape was considered a crime worse than murder, they'd said. Chances were, I was not being abused. The agents hinted that they had plenty going on behind the scenes that could not be shared. According to my mother, the message from Ottawa, almost daily, was that our case was very, very close to being resolved. She lived on those words, very close, never once knowing what they meant. Tension built between my family and Nigel's over how to proceed. Our two families rarely spoke directly, having been instructed to rely on the respective government intermediaries. Disillusioned with the lack of progress, Nigel's older brother Hamilton had begun talking with a man in Australia named Michael Fox. He was allegedly some sort of security expert bounty hunter type, who announced that he had a network of contacts in Somalia and believed that if the Brennan family could come up with $500,000, he could get at least Nigel out. It would mean stepping away from the Australian Federal Police's agenda, but the Brennans were questioning increasingly how effective any government could be in this situation. They also had resources, as Nigel had told me, money banked from the sale of their family farm. Other members of the family had property they could use as collateral for a loan. There was dissent among the Brennans over how to handle my family's lack of funds. If this Fox character was correct, they might be able to come up with the kind of money needed to free Nigel. Why, his brother was wondering, were they being saddled with the responsibility of getting me out too? In early March, my mother had learned that Hamilton had struck some sort of a private deal with Michael Fox, okaying him to go into Somalia and use their family money to negotiate for Nigel. She was devastated. She had angry phone conversations with both Hamilton and Nigel's mother, insisting that the kidnappers would surely take the money, release Nigel, and promptly kill me. Late that month, our two families reached an uneasy truce. The Brennans agreed to call off Fox's efforts and to sink their faith once again in the government agents working on the case, hoping for some sort of breakthrough. But then a blog post surfaced on the internet, sending my parents into a dizzying tailspin. An American blogger reported I was pregnant. His post, on a site that covered war and intelligence issues, was short, containing no specifics. He noted that the information came from Mogadishu, from a source he trusted, but at the same time he warned his readers that it was little more than a rumor. The RCMP negotiators in the house with my mother insisted that it was likely just gossip, one of dozens of unconfirmed stories that had floated out of Somalia since we'd been captured. Quite possibly, they said, it had been planted by the disgruntled Adam or someone close to him in order to boost the urgency of the negotiations. Somalia seemed to be a factory for rumors, with a handful of news websites and uncredentialed bloggers pumping out what passed for information, largely for the benefit of the million or so Somalis who had fled the country and scattered across the globe. And also, it turned out, for the benefit of my mother, who scrolled every morning through poorly translated reports on the shifting curtain of the country's civil war, its clan politics and pirates, and the growing bond between Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda. The media in Somalia was mostly underground and unofficial. Somali journalists attempting to do honest work were routinely threatened, detained, and sometimes assassinated. A number of radio stations had been attacked and forced to close. Some news sites were reportedly controlled by certain clans and accordingly biased in what they reported. It was impossible to know what was truth and what was not. Any news about me and Nigel arrived in unfocused glimpses, either via a blogger or passed on to the Canadian or Australian intelligence agents through a mysterious network of informants. The two of us had been spotted in the back of a car. There were other, more dubious reports, like the one that said I was happily teaching English to Somali children. It would astound me later to learn how accurate some pieces of information had been, how droplets of truth managed to leak out of our otherwise sealed-off existence. My parents had been told, for example, that I'd sprained my ankle early on in the escape house during my weeks of pacing in circles, which was true. My parents had been told that my captors took it upon themselves to bring me ice, a rare commodity in Somalia, which was also true. It was the specificity of these fragments that both alarmed and reassured my mother. Despite the broken English with which it was delivered, the news was often worded in a chillingly sure-footed way. Most of the time, she took it as proof that I was alive and at least partially visible in Somalia, though it could also seem as if I'd been swept away and brainwashed, the phantom woman described in the news bearing little resemblance to the daughter she once knew. One of the more extensive reports, published on a Somali news website after we'd been held hostage for nearly a year, read like this. The journalist, Amanda Lintout, is no longer a Christian. She has avert her belief of Trinity to the worshipping of one God, and that is Allah, the Most High. She is now performing her 5 times of prayer, and she is very contented with her marriage relationship with one of her captors. You can't imagine how they exchange laughter and smiles through gesture, since the couples don't understand each other in terms of languages, said Hashi, one of the captors of Amanda Lintout, speaking to a Somali website on Friday. A reporter for the website, who lives in a house which is some few meters away from the house where Amanda lives, has been closely following the situation of the two journalists and has confirmed that Amanda is gleefully at a certain house in the north of Mogadishu and is regularly performing her feminine work such as washing, cooking, and cleaning the house at which she is residing. The reporter also added he has no enough report about the Australian freelance journalists, but is sure that he is also living in the same vicinity with Amanda. Amanda wears a big black veil, and it is hardly to see part of her body, and is now learning the Holy Quran. We were, I can say with certainty, nowhere near Mogadishu when this particular item was published. It is also worth noting that I was not pregnant, married, or anything close to gleeful. I did no cooking or cleaning either, except just one time, on an afternoon nearly 2 months after our stay in the dark house, when Jamal and Abdullah ordered me to scrub the bathroom that was mine. I think they believed they were humiliating me, but after weeks of being confined to my mat in the thick darkness, it was the best 10 minutes I'd spent all winter. In the spidery light of the ventilation slats, I sloshed water from a brown bucket and an all-purpose powdered detergent around the filthy room, gratified by the freedom of movement, the idea that I was making the bathroom nicer for myself and no one else. With deliberate slowness, I pushed a rag over the sink and around the seat of the pink plastic toilet, dumping extra soap into the bowl, watching it streak into the vortex of dark stains. Just outside my room, Abdullah and Jamal had seated themselves against a wall in the dim hallway. They were deep in conversation, speaking Somali in tones I hadn't heard in a long time, like two friends shooting the breeze. They seemed lighthearted, as if they'd forgotten to go through some routine to work up their normal hostility toward me. I took a chance, sticking my head partway into the hallway, holding up the box of detergent. "Please," I said, "could I wash my clothes in the bucket here?" I hadn't been permitted to take a shower or change my clothes since the escape. When I cleaned my body, I did it while crouched next to the toilet by the water jug. A repurposed cooking oil jug made from yellow plastic with its top cut off and its handle intact, scooping the water with a red plastic cup that floated on the surface. I always washed in a hurry and with an eye toward conserving water, never using more than 2 cupfuls at a time, knowing that if the jug went down to empty, it could be days before the boys bothered to refill it. I smelled bad enough that my captors sometimes came into my room carrying a bottle of cologne, spritzing the air ahead as if clearing a sweeter path for themselves through the fetid dark. That day, sitting in the hallway outside my door, Abdullah and Jamal conferred a moment about me and my clothes. As they did, I caught sight of a moving shadow, a thin figure riffling a light-colored sheet that hung across the doorway directly opposite the hall from my room. Someone had paused there, perhaps to eavesdrop, but then had stepped away. It was the woman. It had to be, the ghost-like other female in the house. I realized it was her bedroom that lay behind the curtain. Her proximity explained why I so often heard her coughing. 5 minutes, Abdullah said, interrupting my thoughts. You hurry. It was impossible to remove my jeans with the leg shackles, but back in my room I stripped off the red dress plus my tank top and bra and put on the heavy black abaya. Returning to the bathroom, working quickly, I dumped the clothing into what was left of the water in the brown cleaning bucket, sprinkling it liberally with soap, and kneading each piece carefully with my fingers, feeling the detergent burning the tops of my hands, thrilled by what that said about its potency. The idea of having anything clean against my skin felt like a tremendous gift. When I was finished, I hung the bra on a bar near the sink. I stepped back into the doorway and held up the dripping dress and tank top for the boys to see, gesturing that they needed to be hung somewhere to dry. I made a move to hand them to Jamal, but he recoiled. The two boys started arguing in Somali. Neither one wanted to touch my things. After some debate, I was told I could hang the clothing myself. This was not a small decision. A few more of the boys were summoned, arriving with their guns. I was allowed, for the first time in 2 months, to step all the way outside my room. I stumbled in my chains, carrying the clothes. As the boys corralled me forward, pushing me down the long hallway, the light intensified, coming through an open doorway ahead. My eyes felt as if they were exploding. I saw flares, a hot, exterminating white swirled with strains of blue and orange. I could make out shapes against the wall, people lining my pathway. Someone shouted in my ear, "Fast, fast, fast." I had spent so many hours imagining the layout of the dark house. Now my brain flooded with actual information. There were doorways, windows, corners. I'd lived here but never seen the place. I was outside suddenly, having stepped onto a sun-drenched concrete veranda, in front of a whitewashed wall. The light made me unsteady. The heat of the cement burned the soles of my bare feet. I felt tears streaming down my cheeks. I couldn't process the blue enormity of the sky above me. Someone gave me a push. "Now, now, fast! Hang here!" Ahead of me was a drooping empty clothesline. I tossed the red dress and the tank top over it and was hustled back inside. The air changed again to clammy and then stifling. I was traveling the hallway, my feet too slow for my body, my eyes floating with sunspots, my mind trying to make sense of what I was seeing. We passed, on the left, a large room where it looked like the boys kept their belongings. Then another open doorway on the right. The room was small but with a window, filled with enough light to make my sore eyes throb, and a person inside. It was Nigel bathed in sunlight, sitting on a mattress with his blue mosquito netting draped like a robe around him. He was reading a book. He did not look up as I shuffled past in my chains. I could tell from the rigid way he held himself that he knew I was going by, but probably felt too scared to look up. They returned me to my mat, shining a flashlight so I could find it inside the black maw of my room. I felt disoriented, my heart pounding. The room seemed even darker than it had before. My eyes struggled to adjust. Later on, someone, I didn't see who, would toss my dried dress and tank top through the doorway. They were practically weightless, absent the dirt I'd scrubbed out of them, smelling like soap and still warm from the sun. For hours afterward, I lay on the mat, my mind running high after the half minute spent in the outdoor air, and also stunned by my sighting of Nigel. I tried not to hate him for what I'd seen. He had books, a window, a net to keep the mosquitoes away. I wondered if he had food, if our captors spoke kindly to him, if he worried about me or knew how different our two situations had become. I wondered what would have happened if he'd looked up and caught my eye, whether it would have given me solace or a window into his mind. I didn't know. I couldn't know. I thought about Nigel relentlessly for days to come, settling ultimately on the idea that I had no choice but to be glad for him, even if I felt whacked simultaneously by a bitter envy. For myself, I was grateful that I'd seen anything outside my room that day. It was a reminder of air, of oceans and continents even. I carefully redrew the map of where we were, putting Nigel and his books toward the front of the house where the boys slept, locating the kitchen and the woman with the cough closer to me at the back, sliding one room next to another like pieces in a puzzle, taking some satisfaction in the power of clicking things into place. Chapter 37, The Snap. One day in the dark house, Skids turned up at my door holding a cell phone. On the other end was a man, speaking in heavily accented English, who said he worked at the Somali embassy in Nairobi. He posed a proof of life question, the first in many months, his voice crackling over the speakerphone. I hadn't heard a voice belonging to anyone but one of my captors since the day after we'd tried to escape. "Tell me," the man said, "where did your mother take you for vacation when you were 9 years old?" The answer was Disneyland, California. Away on a plane. After Skids had carried the phone away, I sobbed for a day and a half straight, unable to stuff my emotions back inside. Still, that call delivered hope. The voice had come from an embassy. An embassy implied order. Even as I wept, my mind seized on the one thread of potential meaning, the single strand of substance in that query, and used it as a tow rope. I convinced myself that the question had been a carefully scripted signal that Nigel and I were going home. My mother had asked it. I had answered. She was reminding me, deliberately, of a trip we had taken. It had to be a clue, a way of letting me know I was soon to embark on the trip I most longed for. They, our families, our governments, had to be in the final stages of getting us out. We were about to be sprung. I knew it. For the next several days, I waited in the dark, letting those feelings percolate, certain that I was enduring my last hours as a hostage, that the door soon would swing open. It took about a week for my hopes to fully vacate. In my heart, an airplane tilted and took off without me. I felt my mind pooling, gushing almost, into the blackness around me. I'd fooled myself. I was alone, truly. The psychic link I'd felt with my mother was a delusion. I understood that now. A ravaging despair set in. My thoughts veered toward the irrational. Emotions hit like flash floods, tipping me when I didn't expect it. Thoughts of Nigel came without warning and dismantled my defenses. I'd feel a wave of affection and worry for him. How is he getting through? What does he tell himself? But it was almost always chased by a dose of paralyzing bile. He blamed the whole escape on me. He's sitting there in sunlight reading books. When I was angry, I spared almost no one. I had way too much time to flay people in my mind, especially my captors. I fostered a vivid fantasy in which I became invisible. I pictured myself moving through the house unseen, tying up my captors one by one. Sometimes I imagined grabbing a gun and shooting them all, every last one. The only person I'd pass over, aside from Nigel, of course, was the woman in the house, the cook. I now had a sharp pain in my left side that kept